Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we welcome back Peter Kuznick, professor of history at American University, co-author of The Untold History of the United States with Oliver Stone. Peter Kuznick is no stranger to our audience. On today's Project Censored Show, challenging the official narrative of the decision to drop the atomic bomb on Japan in World War II. We'll challenge that exceptionalist official explanation this hour with our guest, Peter Kuznick, as we approach the 75th anniversary of the incineration of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Stay with us.
Unthinkable crimes perpetrated by the criminal minds, political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, far for little poison. The weapons manufactured paid for by attacks of all the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. In the times for the master thief, confine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you're probably on the menu.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we welcome back historian Peter Kuznick. Peter Kuznick is professor of history and director of Nuclear Studies Institute at American University. He is co-author of Rethinking the Atomic Bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japanese and American Perspectives. He is co-author with Oliver Stone of the New York Times best-selling book, The Untold History of the United States. I've been using that book in class for years now. It's also a documentary film series. And also, Peter Kuznick is author of The Decision to Risk the Future, Harry Truman, the Atomic Bomb, and the Apocalyptic Narrative. And of course, today, we welcome Peter Kuznick as we come up on the 75th commemoration memorial of the decision to drop the A-bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Peter Kuznick, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you, Nikki. It's always a delight to be on with you. What we're trying to do is with the 75th anniversary, we're trying to preempt the usual nonsense that gets published about Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Public opinion has shifted some, but it's not the dramatic shift that we need. And you look at the recent statements, you know, I've got a few here that I wanted to share. Chris Wallace's new book, Countdown 1945. Chris Wallace, the Fox News stalwart. And, you know, for Fox News, a pretty honest journalist, co-authored a book very recently that was top the New York Times bestseller list for weeks. And he writes there, he says, despite all his misgivings, Truman knew he had to drop the atomic bomb. The Manhattan Project gave him a weapon to potentially end the war, and no matter how devastating their losses, the Japanese refused to surrender. They left him no choice. That's Chris Wallace. The New York Times recently had an article about the 75th anniversary of the Trinity test in Alamogordo, New Mexico. And the Times reporter gives the final word on this to Steve Olson, the author of a book about Hanford, who says, it's very hard to conceive of a set of developments in 1945 that would have avoided dropping those bombs. These are not stupid people. Susan Rice, former National Security Advisor, had an op-ed in the New York Times at the end of 2019 in which she writes, following D-Day, my father was sent to the West Coast to prepare for deployment to the Pacific Theater. He was spared combat by President Harry Truman's decision to drop atomic weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, provoking the Japanese surrender. Susan Rice. The last one I want to mention is Barack Obama. You remember when he went to Hiroshima in May of 2016. It was a great symbolic visit. I'd been urging him to go since he first got elected. And finally, the very end of his presidency, he was ready to go. But no other American sitting president had ever gone. The only other American president who visited Hiroshima was Jimmy Carter, but that's after he was out of office. So it was great that Obama went. But what did he do there? It was so disappointing. Not unexpected, of course, but still very disappointing. First, he goes to the Iwakuni U.S. Marine Base and spends twice as much time at the base talking to the soldiers and the Japanese soldiers and Marines sailors than he did in Hiroshima. In Hiroshima, he spends 10 minutes in the A-bomb museum. Then he goes to the cenotaph to give his talk, And he says there, the first sentence, he says, 71 years ago, on a bright, cloudless morning, death fell from the sky and the world was changed. Death did fall from the sky. The U.S. dropped 2 atomic bombs. He later says that World War II reached its brutal end in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That myth that gets perpetuated through all of these kinds of statements is the founding myth of the American post-war empire. Really, it's the idea that the United States is a noble, heroic, peace-loving, democratic nation that sometimes makes mistakes in the world, but never out of malevolent feelings or out of malign motivations. But what we have here is this idea that the atomic bombs were not only necessary and justifiable, they were actually humane and benevolent acts because they saved the lives of 500,000 American and several million Japanese citizens. The myth is that the only way to end the war without an invasion, in which Truman says 500,000 boys would have been killed, the only way to do that was by dropping atomic bombs. That's the official myth. And that's what all these people are repeating here in these statements.
The further we get away from World War II, the number of people that were allegedly saved in this Orwellian doublespeak grows exponentially.
Yeah, very important point, Mickey. In the beginning, both Truman and Grove said it saved thousands of American lives. Then Truman, in the first drafts of his memoir, said 250,000 American lives. Then Truman raises it in his memoir that's published in 1955 to 500,000 American lives. Later in life, he says 1 million American lives. Then other people double down on that. George H.W. Bush praises Truman's tough calculating decision that saved millions of American lives. So the number keeps going up over the years. Does that reflect the fact that these people had a modicum of guilt? Maybe that's what's going on here. Despite all of Truman's bluster, all of Truman's bragging over the years, never lost a minute's sleep over that decision, that I made it like that, and snaps his finger, and I never look back on it. You know, maybe deep down, there was a lot of guilt and remorse over having done so. I loved that dinner at the end of the Truman presidency with some of the top luminaries, and Winston Churchill came over for that dinner. And then Churchill turns to him and says, Mr. President, I hope you have your answer ready for that moment when you and I are standing in front of St. Peter, and he says, you two are the ones who put off those atomic bombs, aren't you? What do you have to say for yourselves? And the room went silent. And then finally, Robert Lovett intervenes and says, are you sure you're going to be in the same place with the president when that moment comes? And so they diffuse the tension. But even Churchill, his co-conspirator in all of this, had some sense of the moral qualms and raised them. Truman was asked about this by Edward R. Murrow and others over the years. And Murrow says, well, wasn't it a mistake? The war was ending already, and the Japanese were trying to surrender. And then you used the atomic bomb, and Truman, of course, tries to deflect it. But as we'll get into in our discussion today, the evidence is absolutely overwhelming that there was no justification for using the atomic bombs in World War II.
We're talking with Peter Kuznick, co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States, among other books. And of course, that's also a series. There's an entire chapter, in fact, in your book, The Untold History of the United States, Chapter 4, that goes into great detail about that decision to drop the bomb. And I think where you started your discussion here by talking about how is this seen or how does this tend to be covered? And you mentioned several of these more traditionalist kind of interpretations that we still hear coming from very prominent people, very prominent sources. Peter Kuznick, how successful do you think you've been with your research and research of other like-minded folks that you're participating with in the talk that you gave recently with the Smithsonian Institution? Do you see a tide changing? Do you see people more open to the historiographic challenges to the traditional view? Over the years, you've been talking about these issues?
Yes. There are a couple of things going on. Number one is the World War II generation, sadly, is leaving us. And what I've found in trying to understand why people have clung so doggedly to this myth, a lot of it has to do with soldiers' service in World War II, which for many Americans was really the high point of their life. They took enormous pride in their contribution to defeating the Nazis and the Japanese. And so they've created this whole set of ideas around the idea that World War II is a good war. And they don't want to see any questioning of any aspect of that. Even the least questioning, I guess, is a certain fragility, a certain sense that the whole narrative could collapse if even any one little piece of it is questioned. But the irony in that, of course, is by giving credit to the bomb for ending the war, we're really taking credit away from the people who deserve it, whether it was the American soldiers and servicemen and public who sacrificed, and the British, and also the Russians. And there's a deliberate effort, both in terms of the European war and the Pacific war, to interpret it in a way that limits, or in some ways almost eliminates, the Soviet role in both victories. And some people who are at least more honest know and admit that the Soviets played a huge role in the European war, but Soviets also made the difference in the Pacific war toward the end. So on the one hand, we're minimizing or devaluing the role by American troops who actually defeated the Japanese through that terrible combat that was going on there in the Pacific, and many lost their lives. But we're also wanting to discredit or take away credit from the role that the Soviet Union played by attributing this to the bomb. And the other thing is that it justifies continuing reliance on manufacture of, stockpiling of, threatening with future bombs. So if the first bomb was a good thing, then we can create one kind of narrative. If we realize what the bomb was as absolutely unnecessary, immoral, militarily largely irrelevant, then we have a whole new sense of what those actions represented and what the whole nuclear arms race has been, the nuclear history has been. So again, the framing of it, as you know, as an historian, is very crucial to how we see the world today.
Anytime that, even in scholarly frameworks, which is certainly what you're doing here, anytime that traditional narratives tend to be challenged, there's a knee-jerk pushback. It doesn't even seem to rely on sound argumentation or factual support. It's just sort of an appeal to antiquity. It's part of the air people breathe in the United States that they accept historical narratives that we only attack people or countries when they attack us first, or we're only defending freedom. We're an exceptionalist people. That's all part of that narrative.
We sometimes make mistakes, but our motives are always noble. What did Obama say when the troops were coming back from Iraq? I mean, that speech is shocking to me, that Obama, who knows better than this, says that's what makes us unique as Americans. We don't go over there because we're interested in oil or territory or power. We go over there, we do it because it's right. And that's why we went to Iraq. Really?
It's pretty amazing, though. But I believe, too, that the reason that these kinds of myths persist is because of the way history is taught. You're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I am your host, Mickey Huff. We are speaking with historian from American University, Peter Kuznick, co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States, and we're talking about the 75th commemoration / anniversary of the decision to drop the atomic bomb on Japan, the ending of World War II. After this brief musical break, we're going to continue our conversation with Peter Kuznick. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we welcome back award-winning historian Peter Kuznick, professor of history, director of Nuclear Studies Institute at American University, co-author with Oliver Stone of the New York Times best-selling The Untold History of the United States. That's the book and documentary film series. And of course, it's also important to remind listeners that The Untold History has a recent edition, a more recent edition that came out, I believe, in 2019. And the reason I'm reminding listeners of that is there is a new chapter that's a book-length chapter on the Obama years at the end of the new version of The Untold History of the United States. The last part of the book here is how the unthinkable became thinkable again. And of course, right now, we've just been talking about the unthinkable, and that was Truman's decision to drop the atomic bomb on Japan. We were talking a little bit before the break about Obama rehashing this old traditionalist mythology about how lives were saved and how we had to drop the bomb and why this is not just the best decision, the right decision. It seems like historiographically, political characters seem to want that to be the only interpretation or framework to look at this. And that gets us back to this issue of teaching history, because you and I end up talking about so many other things. Sometimes we don't get around to pedagogy and we don't get around to talking about teaching. I wanted to do a little bit of that today because the talk that you gave recently on what every global citizen needs to know about the decision to A-bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the title there hints that what do we need to know about this? What aren't we being taught about this? What is the untold history of this? And I believe, as an historian as well, the reason people accept these mythologies so openly or willingly or unquestioningly is because of repetition, because they fit the exceptionalist narrative, because they tend to feel good about reinforcing the notions of how we see ourselves. Peter Kuznick, can you talk a little about that element and teaching and why that's so significant? Because Trump just said recently that people like us are teaching, and in K-12, historians are teaching young people to hate America.
Well, I don't think I've ever taught anybody to hate America. I think I've taught people to sometimes be disappointed in America for not standing up to its highest ideals and its best sense of self. But American history, like history of all countries, is very complicated. Nations love to tell simple children's stories about their past. It's comforting, it's consoling, it's nice for children when you put them to bed at night. But the same thing that Freud talks about in the evolution of human personality and how you go from these consoling myths about the universe and life, and they get more complicated as you mature. Nations need that too. Nations need to look very, very honestly and soberly at their histories in order to correct, in order to improve, in order to create a different future. One of the understandings that Oliver Stone and I had when we did Untold History was that history is very limiting in a sense, that all people have a sense of history, and that sense of history shapes a lot of what they think and do. I'm looking at the book. I wanted to find the way we say it here. For Americans, like people everywhere, are enthralled to their visions of the past, rarely realizing the extent to which their understanding of history shapes behavior in the here and now. Historical understanding defines people's very sense of what is thinkable and achievable. As a result, many have lost the ability to imagine a world that is substantially different from and better than what exists today. That's really crucial, that to the extent our historical vision is corrupted and narrowed and mistaken, it just limits our ability to understand the world, change policy, and create a better world in the future. But I think we're also going through an exciting period now as a nation. It's a time when we're looking at our history through somewhat different eyes, when the nation seems to be willing to come to grips more than we ever have with the legacy of slavery, with the legacy of racism, with the legacy of sexism. In that sense, this is, I think, a very potentially positive period. And the narratives are shifting quite a bit. And even white Americans are beginning to understand how horrific the impact of slavery has been on this country's history, and a little bit even in terms of genocide of Native Americans. My own Washington football team here finally changed its name after decades and decades of efforts to do that. That reflects a certain kind of change that's taking place. The battles over the Confederate statues, the fights over the names of U.S. military bases. I mean, these are symbolic, but they are quite significant. So there is a rethinking going on, and there has been a rethinking going on also of the atomic bomb narrative. I mentioned the fact that the World War II generation is dying off as one factor, but there are other factors at play also. And we see that younger Americans are much more inclined to be critical of the atomic bombings in 1945 than are older Americans. And I take a little bit of credit for this because Oliver Stone and I highlighted these issues in our books and documentaries. As you know, we went around to campuses all over the country, and what we usually screened was our episode on the atomic bomb. Some people asked us to do Eisenhower or Kennedy and the Cuban Missile Crisis or Vietnam or Obama and Bush. So we did different ones, but our go-to one was usually the bomb decision. And so between the documentaries that got seen by tens of millions of people around the world and the book that's got widely read and the various other offshoots, we've been able to reach a lot of people. And what we're trying to do now with my historian colleagues is to get this out as widely as we can, to inoculate against it so that people can't do these simple-minded kinds of unthinking defenses of the atomic bombing. They're at least hopefully going to be complicating this message. I keep getting invited onto like local radio shows in Indiana and Florida and other places to get to the audiences that you and I aren't usually able to reach.
That's a very important point, Peter Kuznick. Reaching those different audiences, right? Not just on the coasts and in the cities, but everywhere in between. And in many cases, particularly in more rural areas or areas with lower tax base incomes, a lot of teachers are strapped and don't have resources, and they have to use a lot of either very standardized textbooks or old, outdated textbooks, which is historiographically also a challenge. And where are we right now, Peter Kuznick, on the atomic clock? We're past the 2 minutes to midnight.
The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists set up the doomsday clock in 1947. And the closest they had ever come to midnight nuclear annihilation was in 1953. They moved the hands of the doomsday clock to 2 minutes before midnight. And that's after the U.S. and the Soviets tested their hydrogen bombs. The Soviets wasn't actually a hydrogen bomb, but it was close enough. And then they don't move it back to 2 minutes before midnight until January 2018. When it looked like we were likely going to go to war with North Korea, at least Richard Haass, the head of the Council on Foreign Relations, said he thought it was a 50-50 chance we were going to go to war. Other top officials said 25%, but whatever it was too close for comfort. And then with the terrible relations and worsening relations between the U.S. and Russia and the U.S. and China, India and Pakistan, so the hands of the doomsday clock were moved to 2 minutes before midnight. Then in February of 2019, they moved the hands to 100 seconds before midnight. That's the closest we've been to nuclear annihilation in the view of these experts since, really, the use of the atomic bombs in 1945. So the world is a powder keg right now. And among those who have called for the elimination of nuclear weapons is the Pope, who have made a very passionate, articulate, inspirational attack on nuclear policy and even condemning the idea that you would threaten anybody with nuclear weapons. And that's the essence of our policy, is always this implied nuclear threat, the threat of annihilation. But it's gotten, as you know, much more dangerous in recent years. Obama was sadly terrible. He didn't have to be terrible. In June of 2009, shortly after he took office, he made that speech in Prague that won him the Nobel Peace Prize, in which he calls for nuclear abolition. He basically says in that speech, the man is fighting two wars, it's bizarre he won a Nobel Peace Prize, but he says in that speech that the U.S. won't be the first country to eliminate its nuclear weapons, will be the last one. But it's something that the world should do. And that was enough to win him the Nobel Peace Prize. But you look at the actual history, he did pass a New START treaty, but the trade-off was he supported a $1 trillion nuclear modernization program over 30 years, which quickly jumped to $1.2 trillion. We now estimate it's going to be $1.7 trillion. But what's the point of that? The point of it is to make nuclear weapons more efficient and more lethal. And that was Obama's legacy, to legitimize this. You can say, yes, in Obama's nuclear posture review, he downplayed the role of nuclear weapons. So that was a good thing. But he even considered eliminating the first use of nuclear weapons, taking that out of America's doctrine, and he backed down on that. So Obama's legacy on nuclear issues is sadly a very weak one. He eliminated fewer nuclear weapons than pretty much any other president during his presidency, and he legitimized the ongoing use of these weapons, at least as a deterrent. But in reality, we know that things quickly go from being a deterrent to being something that's used and not controlled. But then he handed this off to Trump. And Trump's policies have been much worse than Obama's, in the sense that Trump doubled down on the modernization. Trump immediately said from the beginning that what's the point of having nuclear weapons if we can't use them? And the new nuclear posture review that Trump embraced, not only does he elevate the status of nuclear weapons, but he's also now funding and developing two new nuclear weapons that he thinks will be more usable because they're smaller and aren't as quite as devastating as the huge nuclear weapons we've got. On top of that, Trump has dismantled almost every nuclear treaty, beginning with the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal. Now, that was absurd on the face of it. We're going to get a better nuclear deal with them. They're going to come to their senses. That was absurd. The JCPOA was working brilliantly. The inspectors were going in there. They were seeing everything that Iran was doing. Iran has shipped 97% of its enriched uranium outside of the country. They had decommissioned their centrifuges, mothballed them. This was as successful a treaty as one could have, but Trump dismantles that. Then he pulls the U.S. out of the INF treaty, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, which was also highly successful. According to the U.S. ambassador to Russia at the time, the most successful treaty we've ever had. Then he pulls us out of the Open Skies Treaty, and he indicated he wants to pull the U.S. out of the New START Treaty. His first phone conversation with Putin, Putin says to him, we need to extend the New START Treaty when it expires in February 2021. And Trump says, excuse me a minute. He puts down the phone and he asks his advisors, what's the New START Treaty? The idiot didn't even know what the New START Treaty was. And then he gets back on the phone and says, well, we don't really like that treaty. And Putin has been pushing ever since then for the U.S. to renew that, because eliminating that eliminates the last piece of the scaffolding of the arms control architecture that's been built up since Kennedy's treaty in 1963. And Trump has said, I welcome an arms race. Does the man even know what he's talking about? The current treaty at least puts limits on the number of strategic weapons and the number of delivery systems you can have, delivery vehicles. But once you eliminate that, we get back to a 1980s-style nuclear arms race. And we know what that was like. I'm old enough to remember what the 80s nuclear arms race was like. The world had accumulated by that point close to 70,000 nuclear weapons. I would take my students, as you know, to the A-bomb Museum every year in Hiroshima, and I'd write down the same statistic that by 1985, the world had accumulated the destructive equivalent of 1.47 million Hiroshima bombs. That's where we were at by 1985, and that's where we could get back to again. So the insanity of Trump's policies is even worse, more egregious than the insanity of Obama's policies.
And Obama was carrying on the so-called war on terror from the Bush years, and it seems to have just been escalating further and further, despite that strange awarding of the Peace Prize to Obama. On his way out of office, dropped 25,000 bombs on countries his last year in office alone. And by the sounds of what you just told us, Peter Kuznick, Trump has gone even further than that, bringing the clock closer than 2 minutes to midnight. I'd like to remind our listeners that this is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We are speaking with historian Peter Kuznick, co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. We'll continue our conversation after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Don't you want again? Blood is freedom's stain. Don't you pray? Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we're honored to welcome back Peter Kuznick, professor of history and director of Nuclear Studies Institute at American University, co-author with Akira Kimura of Rethinking the Atomic Bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japanese and American Perspectives. He is also co-author with Oliver Stone of the New York Times bestselling The Untold History of the United States. That's a book and documentary film series. And there's a new edition of The Untold History that came out last year in 2019 with a 200-page final chapter, a new final chapter on the Obama and Trump years going all the way up through 2018. On today's show, we're talking with Peter Kuznick as the 75th anniversary of the incineration of Hiroshima and Nagasaki is upon us in early August. Peter Kuznick, you just brought us up to the present here with what's going on with Trump. And I know historians don't believe technically that history repeats itself for good reason. But let's go back to the root of the talks you've been giving to come back to this historiographically about, well, what do we need to know about that decision to drop the atomic bombs and how that triggered this massive uptick of the threat of global annihilation? What about the politics of that period?
We should go through why many historians know that the atomic bombs were absolutely unnecessary and unjustifiable. The American leaders knew that there were two ways to get Japan to surrender, even earlier than when Japan surrendered, without use of the atomic bombs. It's possible that we could have gotten Japan to surrender, possibly May, but likely in June, and almost certainly in July, without use of the atomic bombs. The first way is to change the surrender terms. The United States had been demanding unconditional surrender. Unconditional surrender meant that the emperor, who the Japanese considered a deity, would be tried as a war criminal and possibly executed. That to the Japanese was unacceptable. We know that in the summer of 45, Douglas MacArthur's Southwest Pacific Command issued a background briefing that said that execution of the emperor to them would be comparable to the crucifixion of Christ to us. All would fight to die like ants. We know that American officials in the State Department, the War Department, understood that it might be impossible to get the Japanese to surrender unconditionally under any circumstances. And for that reason, almost everybody around Truman urged him to change the surrender terms. Leading that effort was Forrestal, the Secretary of the Navy, Henry Stimson, Secretary of War. In fact, the only one who was really pushing Truman not to change the surrender terms was James Burns, who becomes Secretary of State on July 3rd, 1945. But that was Truman's most trusted advisor. That was the person Truman looked to for counsel. And Burns kept saying, you'll be politically crucified if you let them keep the emperor. So Truman, in a Trumpian move, decides to put his own political interests ahead of the interests of the nation and of humanity and refuses to change the surrender terms. Even the week at Potsdam, Stimson kept on pushing to change the surrender terms in the Potsdam Proclamation. Let them know they could keep the emperor. Truman says to his 78-year-old, elderly, somewhat sickly Secretary of War, says, if you don't like it, you can just pack your bags and go back to Washington. But that wasn't only the people on the inside. The Washington Post had an editorial in, I think it was June, called Fatal Phrase, and said that we should really think about making this clear what we mean by unconditional surrender. The Republican leader in the Senate, White, also held a press conference and urged Truman to clarify what we mean by unconditional surrender. Because the irony, of course, is that we do end up letting the Japanese keep the emperor, but not until we didn't drop two atomic bombs on them. So one way to get them to surrender is to tell them they can keep the emperor. The second way, and again, how do we know that that was the turning point? We intercepted Japanese cables between Foreign Minister Togo in Tokyo and Sato, the Japanese ambassador to the Soviet Union in Moscow. And the cables going back and forth said explicitly, the only obstacle to surrender is demand for unconditional surrender. They say His Majesty desires to end the war as quickly as possible now if they'll give us better surrender terms. You know, so we knew that that was the main stumbling block. Truman himself knows that, refers to one of the intercepted cables, the July 12th cable, as the telegram from the emperor asking for peace. Those are Truman's words. All of the people around him knew that that was a major stumbling block. So that was number one. Second way to end the war was to wait for the Soviet invasion. Pearl Harbor was bombed on December 7th. By December 8th, the U.S. officials were imploring the Soviets to come into the Pacific War on our side. Stalin had to fight the European war. He wasn't ready to do so. But finally, at Yalta in February, Stalin agrees to come into the Pacific War 3 months after the end of the war in Europe. Roosevelt and the military leaders were ecstatic. So that would put the date around August 8th or August 9th, 3 months after the end of the war in Europe. We knew that that was going to convince all the Japanese that the war was over. The Joint Intelligence Committee reports on April 11th says explicitly, this is our intelligence, Joint Intelligence with the British, says if at any time the USSR should enter the war, all Japanese will realize that absolute defeat is inevitable. And they've said that repeatedly, that we knew that the Soviet entry would convince the Japanese the war was over. The statement from the Japanese Supreme War Council of May 16th says, quote, at the present moment, when Japan is waging a life or death struggle against the U.S. and Britain, Soviet entry into the war will deal a death blow to the Japanese empire. Explicit as can be. The Pacific Strategic Intelligence Summary for the week of Potsdam, the Navy said that Japan now officially, if not publicly, recognizes her defeat. We knew this from so many sources, but what did Truman know? Truman has lunch with Stalin on July 17th at Potsdam, and Stalin assures him that the Russians are coming in. Truman goes home and writes in his diary, Stalin will be in the war by August 15th. Finny when that occurs. He writes home to his wife, Bess, the next day. The Russians are coming in. We'll end the war a year sooner now. Think of all the kids who won't be killed. They've repeated this among themselves over and over again. Burns' assistant, Walter Brown, was with them on board the Augusta on the way back to the U.S. from Potsdam. And he writes on August 3rd in his journal, he says, aboard the Augusta, the president, Admiral Leahy, and Burns agree, looking for peace. They knew this. This was not something that was subtle. The Japanese, as one of the top American officers said, were pulling out peace feelers by the tons through the Russians during this time. Stalin told Truman explicitly about this during the Potsdam meeting because the Japanese had asked the Russians to intervene on their behalf to get them better surrender terms. And so former Japanese Prime Minister Hirota met with Soviet Ambassador Malik in Tokyo on several occasions, after which Malik wrote back to the Kremlin saying the Japanese are desperate to surrender. They knew that the Japanese were desperate to surrender, which makes the dropping of the atomic bomb so much more significant because the evidence is overwhelming that there was no military reason and no moral justification for using the atomic bombs. And the Russians knew this better than anybody. So when the U.S. dropped the bomb, the Soviets interpreted it exactly the way the scientists had warned the American leaders that the Soviets would interpret it as really that they were the target of the atomic bomb. The Cold War had already begun. Truman had already started accusing the Soviets incorrectly of having broken their agreements, and the tensions were rising. And so when the bomb was dropped, the leaders in the Kremlin interpreted it that this was a warning to them, the most ruthless kind of warning, Truman saying, we're willing to wipe out hundreds of thousands of civilians in order to make our point that if you, the Soviet Union, interferes with America's plans in Europe or in the Pacific, this is what you're going to get. And that's the way they interpreted it. That's the way Zhukov and Stalin and the others interpreted it. And it was a very big factor in accelerating the Cold War at a time when mistrust was growing already between the United States and the Soviet Union.
I'd like to remind our listeners you're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We are speaking with historian Peter Kuznick. He is professor of history and director of Nuclear Studies Institute at American University. We will conclude our conversation after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program for the hour, we have been speaking with Peter Kuznick. He is professor of history, director of Nuclear Studies Institute at American University. He's co-author with Oliver Stone of the New York Times bestselling Untold History of the United States, book and documentary film series, the second edition of which was out in 2019 that has a very long 200-page chapter on the Obama-Trump years. Peter Kuznick is also author of The Decision to Risk the Future, Harry Truman, the Atomic Bomb, and the Apocalyptic Narrative. And we've been talking about that narrative here today on the Project Censored Show. And Peter Kuznick, you just talked about how it was obvious to people paying attention that the bomb was dropped, not necessarily on Japan because it was needed to stop the war with the Japanese, but it was a message to others, including the Soviets. But I want to get to one other issue. You were giving us reasons for why this was happening. And I want to get to another reason. It's also a justification historically. In order to do these kind of things in warfare and to commit these mass atrocities, it's necessary to convince the public that they're inevitable or they're necessary or they're for the betterment of the us versus the them. Anti-Japanese sentiment in the United States goes way back. I mean, it predates World War II. Goes back at least to the 1860s, the Asiatic Exclusion League, the anti-Japanese racism in the so-called Yellow Peril, particularly in California, the anti-Japanese sentiment in the Pacific with China, and the calling of the U.S. to intervene in the war with China. And so a big part of this push, and you mentioned in the Untold History book, you talk about not just the march of war, but the propaganda, the relentless propaganda against the Japanese that dehumanizes them, which is a necessary component when you're about ready to commit genocide. You mentioned certain characters like John DeWitt, the commander of the Fourth Army. You mentioned a whole slew of people, actually, that were pretty rabid in their racism against the Japanese, eventually moving President Roosevelt to Executive Order 9066. Could you talk a little bit, in your estimation, how do you see the role of this propaganda in leading up to the dropping of the bomb?
I'm one of those who argues that the racism was pervasive, it was deep-seated, it was ugly, unconscionable, and it didn't really play into the dropping of the atomic bomb. It might have made it a little bit easier to do so. But the bomb project was initially designed as a deterrent against a German bomb. And in the minds of the scientists, certainly, Germany was the target. 1943, they decided to shift to Japan, presumably because Japan would not get as much information from a dud as the Germans would, who had more capability to develop their own bomb, and we were afraid were developing their own bomb. But the attitude, the racism was really, really pervasive. In American wartime propaganda, when it came to the European war, we differentiated between the Nazi leaders who were pure evil and the German people who we called the good Germans. They were innocent victims. There was no equivalent to the good Germans when it came to U.S. propaganda about the Japanese. The Japanese were subhumans, they were apes, they were vermin. The British Embassy in Washington talked about the American perception of the Japanese as a nameless mass of vermin, and that there was a wide need in the U.S. debates to exterminate the vermin. In March of 44, the British ambassador reported back to London about the universal exterminationist anti-Japanese feeling in the U.S. And Time magazine said, "The ordinary unreasoning is ignorant. Perhaps he is human. Nothing indicates it." Alan Nevins, a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, had an essay, "How We Felt About the War." And he says, "Probably in all our history, no foe has been so detested as were the Japanese." And I could go on. Ernie Pyle, the great war correspondent, shifted from the European front to the Pacific front in February of 45. And he says, In Europe, we felt that our enemies, horrible and deadly as they were still people. But out here, I soon gathered that the Japanese were looked upon as something subhuman or repulsive, the way some people feel about cockroaches or mice. Newsweek says, never before has the nation fought a war which our troops so hate the enemy and want to kill him. I mean, this goes on and on. So the racism was horrendous, and it led to 120,000 people, innocent people, being put in concentration camps in the United States. Now, were there reasons why the Americans were so racist toward the Japanese? Yes. Not the racism part of it, but why they might have hated the Japanese. The horror stories about the Japanese dismembering and castrating and beheading American troops and tying them to the trees and using them for bayonet practice and medical experimentation and burying them alive. I mean, horrible things that after that came out, especially with the Bataan Death March, or the stories about the rape and murder of nuns on the street of Hong Kong and the rape of Nanjing. I mean, the Japanese were really deserved to be harshly condemned for the horrific behavior, especially toward other Asians, but also toward prisoners. An American had a 1 in 20 chance of dying in combat. An American POW in a German prisoner of war camp had a 1 in 25 chance of dying. An American POW in a Japanese camp had a 1 in 3 chance of dying. And there's a lot of reasons, but that does not in any way justify the kind of racism that we saw. It was ugly, ugly, ugly. And it might have influenced our bombing policy, our strategic bombing policy, which changes from the European war to the Pacific war. In the European war, we targeted industrial and transportation sites, strategic sites. In the Japanese war, we targeted civilian populations and tried to burn down the cities. Before we run out of time, let me make a couple other points so we don't get lost. One of the crucial things is that 7 of America's 8 five-star admirals and generals in 1945 are on record as being opposed to the dropping of the atomic bomb, either for moral reasons or for military reasons, either militarily unnecessary or morally reprehensible. And you look at the comments that they made, I'll just mention a few quickly. Admiral Leahy, who was Truman's personal chief of staff and chaired the meetings of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, says the Japanese were already defeated and ready to surrender. The use of this barbarous weapon at Hiroshima and Nagasaki was of no material assistance in our war against Japan. And being the first to use it, we adopted an ethical standard common to the barbarians of the Dark Ages. Number one, General Eisenhower was told by Stimson at Potsdam that we were about to drop the bombs. And Eisenhower writes, he says, so then he told me they were going to drop it on the Japanese. Then he asked for my opinion. So I told him I was against it on two counts. First, the Japanese were ready to surrender. It wasn't necessary to hit them with that awful thing. Second, I hated to see our country be the first to use such a weapon. Eisenhower, who builds up this massive stockpile of nuclear weapons when he's president, always stuck to the idea that he was opposed to the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. MacArthur, who later is notorious for wanting to use atomic bombs and hydrogen bombs during the Korean War, he was virulently opposed to the atomic bombing in 1945 because he knew that the Japanese were already defeated. Former President Hoover sent a memo to Truman in mid-May, urging him not to use the atomic bomb, urging him to change the surrender terms. MacArthur writes to Hoover, says, it was a wise and statesmanlike document, and had it been put into effect, would it obviated the slaughter at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, in addition to much of the destruction in the Isle of Honshu by our bomber attacks. That the Japanese would have accepted it, and gladly, I have no doubt. And that's in May. So MacArthur, who's not known as a pacifist in most circles, thought it was horrific that what we did. And he said he feared the next war, which was going to be 10,000 times more horrific than this war. But the same thing from Hap Arnold, the head of the Air Force, Nimitz, Chester Nimitz, King, they all knew and said that the bombs were unnecessary. And the other side of this reality is that the bombs did not force Japan's surrender. It was the Soviet invasion. The Japanese leaders had accepted the U.S. to wipe out their cities. The U.S. had already firebombed more than 100 Japanese cities. And the Japanese leaders accepted we could wipe out their cities. What changed the equation was the Soviet invasion. Now they had to fight a two-front war. Now they had to fight against the vast Red Army. The Japanese had known since July of 44 that they could not win militarily. And in February of 45, three-time former Prime Minister Konoe writes to the emperor and says, "I regret to inform you, but defeat is inevitable." And the Japanese started doing studies on how to end the war on the best possible terms. And finally, when the Soviets did invade, that changes everything, and it changes the thinking of the leaders. And Prime Minister Suzuki was asked on August 13th, the day before the surrender, why they couldn't delay. And he says, "I can't do that. If we miss today, the Soviet Union will take not only Manchuria, Korea, Karafuto, but also Hokkaido. This will destroy the foundation of Japan. We must end the war when we can deal with the United States." They understood, and the American leaders understood, this reality, that it was the Soviet invasion that forced Japan's surrender. As the National Museum of the U.S. Navy now, here in Washington, D.C., says in its display on the atomic bombs, quote, "The vast destruction wreaked by the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki made little impact on the Japanese military. However, the Soviet invasion of Manchuria changed their minds." That's what forced the surrender. The U.S. post-war reports said that, but this history is not known. And the sad thing about it is that the Americans used the atomic bombs knowing it wasn't necessary because they wanted to. This was a deliberate decision. They wanted to show those bombs, show how powerful they were, show the effects of them. As Brigadier General Carter Clark, who was in charge of preparing them, said, "We brought them down to an abject surrender through accelerated sinking of their merchant marine and hunger alone, when we didn't need to do it. And we knew we didn't need to do it, and they knew we knew we didn't need to do it. We used them as an experiment for two atomic bombs." And the reality is General Groves, who was in charge of the Manhattan Project, said, "For about 2 weeks from the time I took charge of this project, I conducted it as if the Soviets were the enemy." He says to Joseph Rotblat over dinner, a British physicist who's later going to win the Nobel Peace Prize, he says, "You realize, of course, that the main purpose of this project is to subdue the Russians." James Burns says the same thing to the scientists he meets with in Spartanburg. It's a shameful history. It doesn't allow us to put forth this notion of American exceptionalism, moral superiority, because this is an instance in a war that had to be won and that was being won by America's troops. This is an instance of America going for the dark side.
Peter Kuznick, with the last couple of minutes here, 75 years later, what lessons should Americans and others around the world take from that, this untold history?
I think the lesson is that Truman dropped the atomic bombs knowing he was beginning a process that could end all life on the planet. And we've lived with that reality ever since. Truman was briefed on the bomb on April 13th, his first day in office, by Jimmy Burns. And he writes in his journal that Burns told him a weapon great enough to destroy the whole world. Truman gets a full briefing on April 25th, and he writes, "Stimson said gravely that he didn't know whether we could or should use the bomb because he was afraid that it was so powerful it could end up destroying the whole world. I felt the same fear as he and Groves continued to talk about it when I read Groves' 24-page report." At Potsdam on July 25th, he gets a full briefing on how powerful the test was at Alamogordo. And he writes, "We've discovered the most terrible weapon in history. This may be the fire destruction prophesied in the Euphrates Valley era after Noah and his fabulous ark. Not a more powerful bomb, the fire destruction." And he still used it in this most cavalier way. And the reality we've dealt with ever since is that the sword of Damocles hangs over our heads, and we still face on a daily basis the threat of annihilation as a species and as in pretty much all large life on this planet. So that's, I think, the reality, the horrible reality, the frightening reality, because Truman wasn't a bloodthirsty monster. He's my least favorite president, just about. I think he made terrible decisions, but he was not an evil man, a bloodthirsty man. And yet he blindly went ahead, and that's what we've got. So when you've got a Donald Trump talking about he doesn't mind an arms race and he wants to make America great again, and you've got all these other leaders who are approaching things not from the standpoint of what we as a planetary population need, but from the standpoint of their own national, military, and power ambitions, then we're in a world that still is lucky to survive this long and whose future is not guaranteed. We have got to get rid of these weapons. Then we'll still have to deal with climate change, of course. But if we can eliminate the immediate threat to existence of life on this planet, that would at least give us a little more time to try to solve the other problems.
And Peter Kuznick, we really need history and historical wisdom to help light the way here in dangerous and challenging times. We sit down and talk, and the hour slips away so quickly. I do so enjoy talking with you and listening to you, and I want to thank you so much for all of your work and sharing your historical wisdom with us. We've been talking for the hour with historian Peter Kuznick, professor of history and director of Nuclear Studies Institute at American University in Washington, D.C., and he is co-author with Oliver Stone of the New York Times best-selling Untold History of the United States, and also The Decision to Risk the Future, Harry Truman, the Atomic Bomb, and the Apocalyptic Narrative. Peter Kuznick, as always, thank you so much for joining us on the Project Censored Show and reminding us why history matters.
Thank you, Mickey. It's always a pleasure.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaigns.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by myself along with Peter Phillips. I'm the executive producer, Mickey Huff, of this program, also the host. Our co-host is Chase Palmieri. Anthony Fest, our senior producer. Our associate producer is Dennis Murphy. Thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, disguise, under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse, got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison, genocide, wars, far for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece, open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love, we flip the brothers in our